I left the University of Wisconsin in 1931 to find myself in an America, sadly, dislocated. An America offering few opportunities for young energy and enthusiasm. I was smitten with the usual wanderlust. The United States did not seem adequate. I looked around New York for a job. There were no jobs to be had. Something seemed to be wrong with America. I decided to go somewhere else. I began to read extensively about the Soviet Union and gradually came to the conclusion that the Bolsheviks had found answers to at least some of the questions Americans were asking each other. I decided to go to Russia, to work, study, and to lend a hand in the construction of a society which seemed to be at least one step ahead of the American. Following wise parental counsel, I learned a trade before going. I went to work as a welder's apprentice, and several months later received a welder's certificate. Armed with this, with credentials from the Metalworkers Union, of which I was an active member, and with letters of several personal friends, I set off for Berlin, where I applied for a Soviet visa. The welding trust was glad to give me work. They needed welders in many places. Finally, arrangements were completed, and I started out on the 4-day train trip to a place called Magnitogorsk, on the eastern slopes of the Ural Mountains. I was very happy. There was no unemployment in the Soviet Union. The Bolsheviks planned their economy and gave opportunities to young men and women. Furthermore, they had got away from the fetishization of material possessions, which my good parents had taught me was one of the basic ills of our American civilization. I saw that most Russians ate only black bread, wore one suit until it disintegrated, and used old newspapers for writing letters and office memoranda. I was about to participate in the construction of this society. I was going to be one of the many who cared not to own a second pair of shoes, but who built blast furnaces which were their own. It was September 1932, and I was 20 years old. All during the 30s, the Russian people were at war. It did not take me long to realize they ate black bread principally because there was no other to be had. Wore rags because they could not be replaced. In Magnitogorsk, I was precipitated into a battle. I was deployed on the iron and steel front, while political leaders in Moscow were scheming and intriguing, planning and organizing. I worked in Magnitogorsk with the common soldiers, the steel workers, the simple people who sweated and shed tears and blood. For 5 years, I worked in Magnitogorsk. I saw a magnificent plant built. I saw much sweat and blood and many tears. The big whistle on the powerhouse sounded a long, deep, hollow 6 o'clock. All over the scattered city camp of Magnitogorsk, workers rolled out of their beds or bunks and dressed in preparation for the day's work. I climbed out of bed and turned on the light. I could see my breath across the room as I woke my roommate, Kalia. Kalia never heard the whistle. We pushed our coarse brown army blankets over the beds and dressed as quickly as we could. We did not eat anything. We had nothing on hand except tea and a few potatoes. We locked up and set out for the mill. It was January 1933. The temperature was in the neighborhood of 35 below. A light, powdery snow covered the low spots on the ground. A few stars crackled in the sky and some electric lights twinkled on the blast furnaces. Otherwise, the world was bleak and cold and almost pitch dark. It was 2 miles to the blast furnaces over rough ground. Down beside the foundation of blast furnace number 4, there was a wooden shanty. The men gathered round in an ever-widening circle, smoking and talking. By the time the 7 o'clock whistle blew, the shanty was jammed full of riggers, welders, cutters, and their helpers. It was a varied gang. Russians, Ukrainians, Tatars, Mongols, Jews, mostly young and all peasants of yesterday, though a few, like Ivanov, had long industrial experience. On the other hand, Kaibulin, the Tartar, had never seen a staircase, or a locomotive, or an electric light until he had come to Magnitogorsk a year before. His ancestors, for centuries, had raised stock on the flat plains of Kazakhstan. His life had changed more in a year than that of his ancestors since the time of Tamerlane. On the way to the furnace, I met Shabkov, the ex-Kulak, a great busky youth with a red face, a jovial voice, and two fingers missing from his left hand. "Well, Jack, how goes it?" he said, slapping me on my back. My Russian was still pretty bad, but I could carry on a simple conversation and understood almost everything that was said. "Badly," I said. "That doesn't matter," he said. "If you lived where I do, in a tent, you wouldn't think it's so cold here." "I know you guys have it tough," said Popov, who had just joined us. "That's what you get for being Kulaks," he laughed. "Tell me, though, how do they decide who was to be de-Kulakized?" "Ah," said Shabkov, "that's a hell of a question. Just between the three of us, though, the poor peasants of the village get together in a meeting and decide so-and-so has 6 horses. We couldn't very well get along without those in the collective farm. Besides, he hired a man last year to help on the harvest. They notify the GPU, and there you are. So-and-so gets 5 years. They confiscate his property and give it to the new collective farm. Sometimes they ship the whole family out. When they came to ship us out, my brother got a rifle and fired several shots at the GPU officers. They fired back. My brother was killed. All of which, naturally, didn't make it any better for us. We all got 5 years and in different places. I heard my father died in December, but I'm not sure." Shabkov got out his canvas tobacco pouch and a roll of newspaper, and thrust both towards Popov. "Kulak smoke?" He smiled grimly. At this point, a young, boisterous, athletic-looking burner burst into the room and pushed his way up to the stove. "Boy, is it cold," he said, addressing everyone in the room. "I don't think we should work up on top today. One of the riveters froze to death up there last night." "Yeah?" said everybody at once. "Who was it?" But nobody knew who it was. It was just one of the thousands of peasants and young workers who had come to Magnitogorsk for a bread card, or because things were tough in the newly collectivized villages, or fired with enthusiasm for socialist construction. It was just about 9:15 when I finished one side of the pipe and went round to start the other. The scaffold was coated with about 1 inch of ice, like everything around the furnaces. I was just going to start welding when I heard someone sing out and something swished down past me. It was a rigger who had been working up at the very top. He bounced off a bleeder pipe, which probably saved his life. By the time I got down to him, blood was coming out of his mouth in gushes. He tried to yell, but could not. After lunch, Shimichkin, the superintendent, arrived. Then came Mr. Harris, the American specialist consultant, with his interpreter, then Tyshenko, the burly, sinister prisoner specialist. "Well," said Mr. Harris, through the interpreter, "when do you expect to get the rest of the riveting done, on top of number 3? Tyshenko, the chief engineer, convicted of sabotage in the Ramzin trial in 1929, sentenced to be shot, sentence commuted, now serving 10 years in Magnitogorsk, shrugged his shoulders. He was not a wordy man. He'd heard a great deal of talk since 1917 and had decided that most of it was worthless. Shevchenko entered, the assistant director. His main energies were directed toward finding objective or political excuses for the failure of his organization to adhere to the super-ambitious Moscow construction schedule, which everybody knew was impossible to fulfill. Mr. Harris was jotting down figures on a piece of paper. "Now, Mr. Shevchenko," said the American, "orders are orders, but you can't rivet steel without them, and you can't heat rivets with them. We must have those rivets, or the job won't be finished by next Christmas." Shevchenko knew that this was sound. However, Harris's remark created a situation in which it appeared that he, Shevchenko, was the one who was not doing his job as he should. This would not do. The assistant director launched into a long tirade. "Surrounded as we are by hostile capitalist nations, we are forced to industrialize our great country in the shortest possible time, leaving no stone unturned, sparing no one. Here we have assembled all the materials and equipment for 2 new blast furnaces. They must be erected and blown in at the earliest possible date, and yet if I were to believe you, I would be forced to think that the whole job must be held up for a lack of a few rivets. Or perhaps you're not interested. Perhaps you remain unconvinced by the last 15 years. Shevchenko's rhetoric carried him away. His face was flushed, his arm extended. Then, having asserted himself, having placed the party line before the old wrecker and the foreign specialist, thus acquitting himself of the obvious political obligation under the circumstances, he took one of Mr. Harris's cigarettes, drew a stool up to the table, and proceeded to look over the list of materials that the American had made out. There was no question about it, of course. No amount of proletarian enthusiasm, no speeches, could take the place of the inch and a half rivets. That night, outside of the barrack, the wind howled dismally. But in our little room, it was warm. This was the Magnitogorsk of 1933. Quarter of a million souls, communists, kulaks, foreigners, Tartars, convicted saboteurs, and a mass of blue-eyed Russian peasants, making the biggest steel plant in Europe, in the middle of the barren Ural steppe. Money was spent like water. Men froze, hungered, and suffered. But the construction work went on, with a disregard for individuals and a mass heroism seldom paralleled in history. The purge struck Magnitogorsk in 1937 with great force. Thousands were arrested, incarcerated for months, finally exiled. No group, no organization was spared. For centuries, Russia was governed and administered with the help of a secret police. Their methods were traditionally clumsy, brutal, and inefficient. It was considered worthwhile to condemn 9 innocent defendants in order to get 1 guilty one. Sometimes whole villages of innocent people were destroyed in order to get some guilty peasant leader. For centuries, the attitude towards foreigners was one of fear and mistrust. The October Revolution changed many things in Russia, but the above-mentioned century-long traditions and habit patterns are still present in the Soviet Union. They conditioned the character and successful execution of the purge, which might well have caused an insurrection or a civil war in England or the United States. A large number of spies, saboteurs, and fifth columnists were exiled or shot during the purge, but many more innocent men and women were made to suffer. By 1935, Shevchenko, the assistant director, had been promoted to the post of manager of the coke and chemical plant. He received the Order of Lenin and was made a member of the District Party Committee. In 1935, his friend Mariasin, already working on another job, was arrested as an agent of the Japanese Secret Service and an active Trotskyite. From that time on, Shevchenko was worried, took to drinking more than was good for him, and made even more ardent speeches at meetings. Then a worker arrived from some town in the Ukraine and began to tell stories about Shevchenko's activities there in 1920. Shevchenko gave the man money and a good job, but still the story leaked out. One day, about a year later, Shevchenko was removed from his post, along with half dozen of his leading personnel. Shevchenko was tried 50 months later and got 10 years. Shevchenko was at least 50% bandit, a dishonest and unscrupulous careerist. However, in all probability, Shevchenko was not a Japanese spy. Soviet purge techniques were highly developed. All arrests were made at night. Surprise was always sought for. People were arrested when they least expected it, and left alone for weeks when they expected every night to be taken. The arrests were made by agents having no idea of the accusations against the person being arrested. After someone's arrest, the family was usually left completely in the dark for several weeks, while the arrested was put in the Magnitogorsk prison to cool off and think things through prior to the first investigation. Several weeks after the arrest, the family usually received a formal notice that the husband or brother had been arrested, and that the family could come at such and such a time with a package. They suggested that the package should contain warm clothes, clean underwear, sugar, onion, and garlic. The latter were to combat scurvy, which became rather common in the prison owing to the predominantly bread and water diet and the lack of fresh air. In Magnitogorsk in 1937, the activities of the NKVD were often characterized by great confusion. in cases where numbers of responsible workers and functionaries had been arrested at the same time or within a few days of each other, production suffered heavily for a while. After Shevchenko's removal and arrest, for example, the coke and chemical output went down sharply for several weeks. During the first few days, chaos reigned in the plant. A foreman would come to work in the morning and say to his men, "Now, today, we must do this and that." The workers would sneer at him and say, "Go on, you're a wrecker yourself. Tomorrow they'll come and arrest you. All you engineers and technicians are wreckers." And indeed, Alexei Ivanovich Pushkov, the chief of the Magnitogorsk NKVD during 1937, was himself purged in 1939 for his excessive enthusiasm in purging the people of Magnitogorsk. I left Magnitogorsk with considerable regret. I'd put in 5 of the most active years of my life in its mills. My fingers had helped mold the blast furnaces. I had sweated in the heat of summer, frozen my nose and cheeks in the Arctic winter winds. I'd watched millions of tons of iron and steel roll out of Magnitogorsk to Soviet machine building and armament works. When I left Magnitogorsk, I was profoundly shocked by the fact that so many people I had known had been arrested. The whole thing seemed stupid, unreasonable, preposterous. The Stalinist Constitution of 1936 had promised a democratic and free society. Instead, the NKVD seemed to have run away with the show. The purge appeared to be consuming everything that had been created. I mentioned this to my Russian friend Shemichkin when I went around to bid him goodbye. "If I am not mistaken," he said, "you in America tolerated chattel slavery for nearly a century after your great Constitution of Freedom went into force. Your elections were travesties of universal suffrage during the first decades after your revolution. Our Soviet Constitution is a blueprint of the future. It is a picture of what we are building, and we will build it too. Now our elections are ludicrous, of course, civil liberties are restricted, but we are not yet one generation old, and we are at war now. Do not forget it." One conclusion I reached before I left Magnitogorsk I still believe to be sound. Westerners have no place in Russia. It is the Russians' country, and it is their revolution. Men and women from Western Europe and America may occasionally succeed in understanding it, but it is almost impossible for them to fit into it. I survived black bread, rotten salt fish, the cold, the hard work, which was unusual. I did not survive the purge. I think I understood it, its causes, its inevitability in Ubergang's period Russia, but I could not live with it. I probably could not have stuck it out, even had it tolerated me. I went to Moscow and became an observer, which was, perhaps, all I had ever been, really.